Okay, welcome to the Stage Left podcast, lifting the veil on the music industry by telling the stories of those with a unique vantage point. On this episode, we feature another unsung hero of the music industry, Monty Oxymoron. Monty will be talking us through his eclectic musical tastes, how Syd Barrett's Pink Floyd influenced him as a child, and what it was like to then share the stage with members of Pink Floyd to honour the memory of Syd at a tribute show to mark his passing. We'll also find out how Monty has balanced a significant career in the music industry alongside being a fully qualified practicing psychiatric nurse. Monty joins me in Hastings on the south coast of England just before soundcheck for a sold-out show this evening with the legendary punk band The Damned. It's a pleasure to have you with us, Monty. How's it going?
Okay, not too bad.
Good, good, good. So you've got your soundcheck coming up in a little while, and you were telling me before we started recording that you had a soundcheck last night and it took 3 hours. I mean, your level, and it's amazing that a soundcheck would take that long. What went wrong?
Well, basically, it seemed as if the chappie who was doing the monitor desk didn't know what he was doing. He was just kept looking at it as, what's this knob? I think it took him about half an hour to get both of my keyboards in the wedge.
Oh, really?
Just that. And then there was more complex things like these in-ear monitors that Captain and Pinch and Avanian have. And that was just a nightmare trying to get those set up.
I mean, obviously you've played thousands of gigs, you're very experienced, you know your equipment well. What personally is the main thing that you're looking from a sound check? Is it for your fallback monitors and your wedges to be clear for what you're playing or what the rest of the band is playing, or a balance?
It's a balance, really. I mean, obviously you've got to hear yourself, because otherwise if you haven't got it in your monitor, all you've got is a sort of distant echo from the out front, which is no good. But also you want to hear certain other people, especially certain aspects. You want to make sure that the drums are loud enough. Sometimes I don't need them in the monitor, but if they're near to me.
Yeah.
But for timing's sake, that's really important.
You want that snare nice and loud coming through.
Yeah, and then other vocals, we do quite a few harmony vocals.
Right.
So I need to be able to hear Captain and Dave's singing as well.
And I mean, obviously last night's soundcheck was particularly long, but I mean, what's the normal setup for a soundcheck? Do you run through, a number of songs you're playing on the evening, or do you test out, do you noodle a load of different new stuff? How does it work? What do you normally do?
It usually starts off with a kind of line check, just to make sure that you can hear what each instrument needs, what each person needs in terms of instruments. And then we might jam a bit, mess around, and then we'll do an actual song or two. And if you've got time, you might work on a song or two if there was something slightly ropey or whatever that was worth looking at.
Yeah, just to smooth it over.
Yes.
So obviously you're on tour, and it is an extensive one. You go to Italy, I think, next. Then you're into America, so you go to Denver, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Detroit, Cincinnati, Chicago. Then UK dates before finishing up at the Royal Albert Hall.
Yeah,
life must be pretty good.
Yeah. I've got my sister's wedding in the middle of all that as well.
Oh, wow, that's some timing. So how does the prospect of touring feel these days? Does it still excite you, or fill you with dread, or how does it feel going on the road?
Oh, the actual playing I still love, and I like going to places. The actual process of going to places I'm not always so keen on. Flying in particular, I get scared. I have to take Valium and stuff because I hate turbulence.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's not that much like travelling in the van for hours and hours, especially if you get stuck in loads of traffic like we did the day before. Is no fun either. And then there's the business of sometimes we travel on a tour bus if we've got quite a few gigs in a row. And that's good in that you can travel at night. So you get the journey done while you're sleeping, hopefully, and you wake up in a new place and you can go and explore. You've got time to explore the place, which obviously if you're travelling all day you can't really do. You go straight to sound check. But the only problem with being on the bus, I find, is there's the kind of lack of privacy. You're all on top of each other.
Touring these days, I mean, obviously you've done it many, many times. Are there any particular gigs that you look forward to? When you look forward to particular gigs on a tour, is it because of the venue you're playing in regards to the acoustics, or is it the city you're visiting? Or
it could be a mixture of those things. Sometimes it's the people you might see, especially going to the States. Sometimes you people you don't see for years, and you think, oh, I'm going to see that person, that's great, you know. So that's another thing as well. But yeah, certain venues as well are really nice, and certain places are really nice. You get your favourite places.
Yeah. I mean, that kind of leads me nicely on about where you say that he's kind of bumping into old faces. One of the things in my kind of research for this podcast was when I've looked into the Damned and you know, a lot of their fans, and I've seen a lot walking about town already today, many of them have seen the band like over 200 times. Like, it's like they're real, real loyal fan base. Why do you think the fans keep coming back?
Well, hopefully because we're bloody good. But I think there is also I think there is that thing about punk bands in particular, that you do get very, very loyal followings of people who come and see you all the time. But yeah, hopefully it's because we're still doing the business, we're still doing good stuff. And even though there's been lineup changes and changes in star and different things, you know, there are people who've still gone with it and keep coming.
Great. Okay, so, I mean, is there any, in regards to touring, is there any kind of pressures that we don't see in regards to touring? I know, obviously, it's interesting to say about, you know, scared of flying and that kind of thing, and kind of the claustrophobic feel. Is there any other pressures that we don't see? Because to musicians like myself who love to be on tour and that kind of thing, it seems like the dream job. But is it a bit more of a head scratcher?
Well, I mean, it depends on how smoothly things are going. I mean, I think the last couple of days is a case in point. I mean, that sound check was actually a nightmare. I was really getting very, very stressed. I took a tablet to calm me down because I was starting to get, you know, stomp about and get angry and stuff. Shut up! Shut up!
Say high profile gigs or kind of big gigs that you've done in the past, how do you deal with kind of, I mean, do you feel pressure when you play these gigs, or do you you know, what do you do with the nervous energy beforehand, or have you never had that problem?
Yeah, that's a good one. Sometimes Captain finds me in the dressing room just kind of sitting there staring into space. Says, are you festering again? Sometimes I do that. I don't quite know what to do with myself. I can't kind of read or do, you know, actually focus on doing something. It's not so much I feel it nervous, just kind of
restless.
Yeah, restless is the word.
Yeah.
And I do have a drink or two before going on stage. Now that's a fine art that has to be perfected over time. When I first joined the band, you know, I have to say there were a few gigs where there was some ropiness, and Dave soon took me aside and said, "Oh, yeah, be a bit careful there."
Yeah.
And I said, "Oh, well, but I did all these other gigs that were fine, and it was only that one." He said, "That's the one they'll remember."
Yeah.
And of course, nowadays, you don't know, but every single gig might end up on YouTube.
Of course.
So you know, you've got to try and do your best. So you don't want to be embarrassing. And so there's a fine line of how much you just need enough to make you to loosen you up,
take the edge off,
to take the edge off and make you more what's the word, disinhibited, but not so much interfere with your concentration of your playing. So it's got a fine line.
Still mastering that at the moment.
Well, I hope so, yes.
Good stuff. And how did the larger scale gigs, say like the outdoor festival gigs you might have done, compare to the intimate ones? So I know that you did one at the 100 Club. You decided to go back to the 100 Club a few years ago now. It's kind of marking the anniversary of when the Damned played there before. I mean, I played the 100 Club. It's a very, very small intimate venue. Was that a bit of a culture shock for you to play there again, or
no? It's interesting. We had that experience again recently. We played in Berlin. What's it called? Wild at Heart. That's right.
Right.
That's a venue in Berlin, and that's like that. It's a very intimate punk rock venue. Really nice. The people who run it were really nice to us, and it felt really nice and intimate. No, it almost feels like you're going back to the punk roots when you're doing a gig like that.
Yeah.
But it's so different to, playing, say, supporting Motorhead on a great big huge stage. Was it the Wembley? Was it Wembley Arena? Was it Arena or the... the Arena, not the stadium. But, it's still bloody big.
Yeah.
And that, I like that as well. I like having space again. I think that's where the movement comes in. I tend to get off more on moving about. I've got lots of room to... run around.
I'm glad you said Wembley Arena, because that's a venue that I won't pay to go to, because I've been there before and the acoustics are awful from the audience. It's like absolutely horrendous. Right. What's it like on stage? I suppose all the fold-back monitors and the wedges are fine. Absolutely fine, yeah. Oh, the sound, you know, it was a few years ago that I think even Bury was playing there, and I thought, this is might be the only chance I get to see Bury, but I wouldn't part with my money to give it to Wembley Arena, because the acoustics are so bad in there. Yeah. But that's really interesting that you don't notice that on stage. Yeah. Talking about great acoustics in London, you're playing the Royal Albert Hall, I think, coming up. Have you played there before?
No, never. No, a lot of my sort of heroes in that have. I've been looking back, and Frank Zappa famously used the organ to play Louie Louie on. And, as Don Preston, I think, played that. And then there was The Soft Machine as well. Yep. Just been reading Robert Wyatt's biography. That was really interesting about how they... The security initially wouldn't let him in. They said, oh no, they only have proper musicians in there. So he looked a bit scruffy, you know, long hair and all that. It'd be great.
You must be looking forward to that. I mean, that doesn't get more prestigious or grand.
No, that's right. Fantastic.
Here's a love song, and it makes me glad to say it's been a lovely day, and it's okay. It's okay. I think
the energy is in the song, so I think when you start playing the song, some of them are so exciting. And there's light and shade in the song. I think that's one of the things that missing from some of the later punk. They just had this idea of just bash, 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 bash all the way through. Whereas ours have, our songs, some of them have light and shade, so they're crescendos and stuff like that. Eloise, oh yeah, yeah, Eloise. My Eloise. Ha! Hey, you know I'm on my knees. I keep begging her, please. My Eloise is like the stars that please the night, sun that makes the day, lights the way. And when that star goes... The Damned are a band who have kind of evolved their sound continuously from quite hardcore... the hardcore punk. They're the first punk band from the UK to release a single. They evolved to kind of rock and goth, and they have played people like Chrissie Hynde playing for them, Glenn Matlock, Lemmy from Motörhead, guests, Nick Mason from Pink Floyd produced one of their albums. Joe Strummer appeared on records as well. Tell us how you've evolved the band's sound since you've joined, because you come from a very different background musically. How have you evolved? What have you brought to the band? Wow, well, it's difficult to say. Obviously, there's more keyboards than there was, but mind you, there was quite a few keyboards on the Black Album and Strawberries already. I think a lot of my aesthetic, I found that I dovetailed quite well with both Captain and Dave Anion, and their interest in music was, I found that, I think I already knew that Captain was a Syd Barrett fan. We were both into early Floyd and the Soft Machine as well, and other people like Terry Riley, Arthur Brown, all those people. So we had quite a lot in common, especially that Canterbury scene stuff. So obviously he was pleased to have someone who had that knowledge, could bring that out more. I think that got added, particularly on the last album, So Who's Paranoid. And also with Dave, I think his interest in I suppose more sort of like filmic music and classical music, and the old 60s garage punk. So there was a lot in common with both of them. And the other one, what's it, the Satanic Majesty's album, the Stones. That's another one that we shared a lot
passion for.
Great.
And tell me, the songs that you play on now live that you didn't play on record kind of from the 70s and 80s, how did you write your own parts? I presume you wrote your own parts there. Did you have to kind of speak to the other guys about what they wanted on each song?
I'm trying to think. I certainly at the beginning, I think I was guided by yeah. Captain to do certain things. But I was so familiar with the songs already, because I'd listened to them so much from being a fan, had all the albums, that it was fairly easy for me to learn those parts and maybe develop them slightly in certain sort of subtle ways.
Did you have anxiety, the fact that they were obviously so well-known, done in a particular way, and then here you were writing extra parts on top, or were you there just to sit underneath in the sound?
Oh, I don't know really. I mean, I'm very much into improvised music.
Yeah.
And so, to some extent, sometimes over time I've played things differently. I think, I might try this or I might try that. And you know, sometimes some things work better than others.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, the bands I liked when I was younger, I was always interested in hearing stuff live, you know, recordings, bootlegs it always used to be in those days. And all of them were different because there was a certain amount of improvisation. I'm not so keen on bands that just do carbon copies of their albums.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think, what's the point of that?
Might as well just listen to them. Yeah.
This is a live set, you know, and especially if they're actually using, you know, like backing tracks and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's different if you're using some sound effects or something like of that, or an intro or something. We've done that.
Mm.
But the actual song, I think, should be a live experience. And I think we're one of those bands who really provide that.
Yeah, yeah.
So absolutely. You never know quite how it's going to be. There's a certain amount of jamming and improvisation. Sometimes you have a lot of fun with it. It almost gets vaudeville.
Yeah.
So that's great fun for me.
Great. And I mean, one of the songs, one of the highlights of the So Who's Paranoid album is Nature's Dark Passion, which I know appeared both on your solo album and appears on that album. Did you write that song with Dave in mind, or the band in mind? Was that kind of, did you approach that as, right, this is going to be a song for the band, or is that just one you presented that, you know, single thing?
It started out, I think, as an idea for a song, because I was thinking of music that has chord progressions that kind of go up and up and up.
I've seen a light haunting and bright that won't give me any rest day and night. I've heard a refrain, it echoes your name. I hear it again, again and again, and I can't let it go. It's madness, I know. This feeling that's churning and burning and tearing my soul.
Wagner's Tristan and Isolde, I was thinking of that. I mean, that's an incredible piece of music that just kind of rises and rises. And also the music for the Dracula movie, the Coppola Dracula movie, similar sort of thing.
Well, that's what I was into, because it's a very epic sounding song. It's kind of definitely got classical roots in it. It's quite dark, and it's very removed from actually a lot of your other stuff, I'd say. So
yeah.
I just wondered if it was something you consciously sat down and go, right, I'm writing this for Dave, I'm writing this for the Damned, or whether it was just something that came out of you. And
it's something that came out of me in the middle of the night.
Wow.
It's funny, there's that line, isn't it? I lie here awake. I make a mistake. I was lying there, and this thing came to me. I was going through a particularly inspired phase there.
Since I Met You was on that album as well.
It came to me in the night, and I thought, I can't do anything with this, because, you know, Kirsty's asleep next to me. I don't want to disturb her. She's got to get up in the morning. I just went over it and over it and over it in my head. Just the bones of it. There was just the progression. And then I woke up and I thought, is it still there? Because I have come up with things in the night,
and they're gone
in the morning. But it was still there, fortunately, so I could just play it and put it down quickly.
Because Not Free to Love, another song of yours, off your solo album, that would have suited the band as well. It's quite a similar vein, isn't it? Quite similar vein.
Oh, yes. I think I tried to play that to Captain, and he turned it off straight away.
Really? Oh,
yeah. I think it was too anguished, too guilt ridden. You know, he sometimes says, "I'm you know, like I had a powerful religious background when I was young." And
right.
He says, "I'm still dominated by guilt." I don't even know. Maybe right there, even though I don't follow the belief systems anymore. It's still in there. You know, I mustn't do anything bad. You know.
Well, it must have been interesting that Arthur Lee's Love was an album that kind of Arthur Lee's a musician, and you know, the whole Love project. Any other kind of early recommendation listeners might not so well from that era? Because that was kind of very liberating music. And obviously, yeah, if you were a young man and you were kind of perhaps had kind of strict ideas about how you should behave and that kind of thing, that kind of music is very kind of entwined with psychedelia and drug use and that kind of thing. Yeah. So I can kind of see where that anxiety might have come from. What about like other recommendations for listeners around that period that you could say was music that influenced you?
Oh, gosh. For me, well, obviously, I've got to say that what got me through school, I think, was I suffered a lot at school. I was very, very unhappy, sort of a lot of depression, anxiety, and lack of confidence in myself. And I was totally immersed in music then. And I suppose the two bands that got me through that were, one was The Damned,
great,
which it kind of set me up for, you know, come on, you can survive this stuff. But the other was Gong. Gong were like something I could retreat into, and it's like this psychedelic escapism. You know, I could go into another world listening to that stuff.
Fantastic.
And I got to know David Allen of Gong for over some years. He was doing some workshops near Glastonbury, and I went along to those. They were sort of like encounter group type things, and sort of meditations and visualizations and all that kind of stuff. We'd spend the whole weekend doing this.
And how was that for you to kind of then be with him and being involved?
It was amazing. It was just incredible. You know, I suppose for me, being with him, it was like other people might think of, like David Bowie or the Beatles or something like that. You know, he was like, you know. So it was great.
And he got you through your school years and the difficult times.
That's right.
It's nice that he went full circle.
Of course, sadly, he died early this year, which was very, very sad.
I know Syd Barrett was someone who's influenced you a lot, and you did play a tribute night to him after he passed away. Talk us through that night. I mean, it was an incredible bill, incredible gig. Tell us what you remember about that whole kind of evening and the run up to it.
Yeah, that was an incredible thing. Really, really enjoyable. Gosh, it was all like a whirlwind really, because we had to rehearse the day before with the house band. So obviously me and Captain rehearsed on our own first, and we went and rehearsed with the house band. They were great, fortunately.
Andy Bell on bass, I think you had Andy Bell on bass and some other good players. And as you were learning it kind of separately, did you just do the structure of the, as it appeared on record, or how did you mix about with it at all?
I think it was pretty much structured the way it had to be, really, the way it was on the record. As much as possible.
And tell us about that whole evening. That must have been incredible.
Oh, it was amazing. I mean, meeting some of those people. I mean, again, talking about absent Soft Machine friends, we met Kevin Ayers. Captain's a big Kevin Ayers fan. And they got on like a house on fire. They're like old mates, you know. It's great.
Excellent.
Captain was feeling a little ill. I can't remember what it was, a stomach upset or something. Kevin Ayers said, "Oh, come in here, you know, into the dressing room," and opened up this big bag of doctor's bag, like of medicines, and gave him some stuff out of there.
Wow.
And then there's, who else did we meet? Robin Hitchcock. I've met Robin Hitchcock before. I love some of his stuff. And who else was there? Oh, just so many people. Of course, we got to meet actual members of the Floyd, you know, just briefly, Dave Gilmour, and also Rick Wright has also sadly passed away.
I think it was the last time that all four of them were kind of in the same, under the same roof at the same time.
I'm pretty sure
it might have been, or one of the last times, certainly.
Yeah, they didn't play all together. They didn't all play together, no.
But three of them did, didn't they?
Yes.
Yeah.
And it was nice meeting Rick Wright, because obviously, again, he was another person who influenced my playing a lot in many ways. And I tried to talk to him about the technicalities. I was saying, I really like your Eastern modes that you used to do. And he sort of frowned. I thought, oh, no, he doesn't want to talk shop, does he? And he just escaped by saying, oh, I really liked what you did. Oh, thank you very much.
That'll do.
That was it, you know. But, yeah, it was very nice. You know.
And, I mean, did you feel in any way overwhelmed? Or, I mean, the fact that they were obviously a big, you know, massive band in the time you were growing up, and I know Syd Barrett was such an influence on you to play again kind of on the same stage as those guys on the same night.
It was something incredible, really. Yeah, almost unreal. And it took me back to my uncle played me Pink Floyd in the early days when the stuff first came out. So I was only about 6 or 7 years old, and he played me Piper at the Gates at Dawn and all these bootleg stuff.
because he had a pirate radio station in Cambridge called Radio Ginger, and he was playing all this stuff. And had lights set up, and it was like a culture shock because he was all part of the sort of alternative scene. You know, my grandparents were in a quite reasonably straight sort of, and my own parents as well. So it was like a real change, you know, it was really, for a young person, it was just, wow, what's all this? All these colours and interesting smells and sounds, and and all these homemade sort of sound effects things, and so it took me back to that as well. But I think it was kind of funny at the end, we were all on stage together, everybody doing a version of Bike. And it was funny because there were so many people on the stage, it was obvious that one half of the people on the stage couldn't hear what the other half was doing. So it went to horrendously out of time. I heard the recording of it, you know. But in a way, it kind of fitted because some of Sid's albums are sort of on the edge like that. They're almost falling apart, but they still sort of kind of make sense. that was fun. Yeah.
Amazing. Talking about your kind of psychedelic influences, one of my favourite things about being involved in this podcast is I get to listen to artists' back catalogues and other kind of stuff they've collaborated with and discover a load of new music. And never has it been more enjoyable this week than hearing the Dr. Space Toad Experience.
Percussion, take an African drum or something like that and join in with them. And this was when I was studying art psychotherapy at Goldsmiths in the day, and then fortunately I had the evening Monday nights free regularly, so I was going along to that. And when I'd finished the course, so I can't remember how it became a band. I think there were two people there, Andy and Sally, who became kind of said, look, why don't you make this a band? We'll take it out and do some gigs. And I still had my uncle's old drum kit. I was playing drums then.
Oh, wow.
And I had my uncle's old drum kit, which I was playing with the band until it started falling to bits. I think I finished it off once in a fit of fury one night because it was falling to bits. And then moved to keyboards instead, and we got another drum, and that was much better.
Mm.
And then I thought, I should be playing keyboards. I love playing drums. I really like doing it now and again, but it would seem better to do. And
it's a great album though, The Space Toad. Like seriously, everybody should check it out. It's
very, very
mind-blowing.
Eccentric, English eccentric lunacy.
Love that quote. Okay, and in your own material, it's obviously very removed, as we've said, from kind of some of the stuff you do in the jam, some of it. Your use of dialogue is quite prominent in it. So there's a lot of kind of talking. Is that kind of some kind of internal dialogue that you're kind of giving a bit of liberty to, perhaps?
All right. What were you thinking of?
I'm not sure. Well, you can ask me the quotes now. It's just throughout listening to your whole kind of back, you know, your back catalogue stuff you've been involved in. There's a lot of. It's also with Dr. Space Toad as well.
Yeah,
there's a lot of kind of dialogue and that kind of thing. And I've noticed it's on some of your material as well. So the Monty, the Moran album, and the Monty Oxymoran album that I've posted.
Right.
Yeah, and I just wondered if that's something you've decided to use.
I don't know, maybe it's unconscious. I do talk to myself a lot. I always did at school, you know, I got stick for that, you know, and people say it's the first sign of madness, but it's actually hearing voices answering you, I think, that you ought to worry about. But,
Different voices, because you've used different effects on voices and that kind of thing as well, haven't you? And it just sounded like there was some kind of internal dialogue that you were giving an opportunity to be heard.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I did do some pieces with my grandmother when she was alive, bless her. She appeared at the South Club with me doing these bits. She was reading her dreams out. And I've set some music to her dreams. And then there's another one which is a story that she told and she recorded in 68, I think it was. My uncle recorded it and I put music to that.
Wow.
And
Very creative.
That was fun to do. Yes,
yeah. And original. Yeah. And original, because you never know what's going to come out in these dreams and that kind of thing. Yeah. And, you know, so it's living art in many ways, isn't it?
Yeah.
You're just, yeah.
Well, I've later heard of that excellent album of Terry Riley doing the same thing. I think it's on John Zorn's label, and he's doing these, reading these dreams and doing the music to it.
Cool. Okay, so you obviously mentioned your art psychotherapy course that you did. I know that you've kind of been a psychiatric nurse as well as kind of obviously been a musician, kind of juggling those two things. You know, you've said in the past that the nursing profession has kind of helped you develop the ability to work with people. Could you elaborate on that for us?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think before I did nursing, I think I was completely socially inept. I had no idea at all how to relate to people. I think when I was younger, before I got all the trouble at school, I was this kid who wouldn't stop blurting things out, you know, really stupid things and getting very, very hyper and oh, for God's sake, shut up, you know. I think I'd say things at the dinner table. I think my father foolishly gave me cider with dinner. It was probably a bad idea. Got a bit too fond of it. Then I'd start saying really silly things, and my father's friends said, "I do wish to know that. Kindly leave the stage," and things like that. But then when the bullying started, I went completely the opposite way. And nobody wants to know what I'm saying, or nobody's interested in anything that I do or think or anything. And I got very quiet, introspective, a bit paranoid.
Yeah.
And I just socially inept. You know, I didn't have a girlfriend until I was nearly 30. First relationship. Just totally socially inept. I mean, it did mean that I'd spend a hell of a lot of time banging around on instruments and stuff in the room and listening very intently to music, so it was useful in that way.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, the nursing really threw me. It was totally baptism of fire. I don't know how I got through it or how I managed to qualify and do it, because it is such a responsible job and it involves so much communication. It's so important. It's the most important thing in there, really, is communicating, making sure people get the right information that they need to carry on, you know, looking after people and talking to relatives and negotiating with people who are psychotic or whatever, trying to find ways of getting them to behave in the way it will be useful to themselves, and yet at the same time, you know, feel that somebody understands them and sort of gets their point of view.
Mm-hmm. And dementia patients you work
with as well. Yeah, that's what I work with now. It's pretty much always people. Well, yeah, it's mostly people with dementia in the home, and that can be tremendously rewarding, although also
challenging,
very stressful as well.
Yeah,
I don't think I could do it full time anymore. I really don't. I really admire the nurses who do it full time. I couldn't do it. I couldn't cope.
it's something close to my heart. I mean, I actually run a project at a charity. Doing this podcast isn't my full time job. I run a project at a charity, a disability charity that helps people who learn disabilities become more independent, socially kind of less socially isolated, if you like, through volunteering. The whole idea of the project is kind of include more people in society. I know that you ran a music group for adults with learning disabilities for a while, is that right?
I co-ran it.
You co-ran it, okay.
I think it was mostly my friend Rod Payton.
Okay.
He's a great French horn player and composer, and he was one of the tutors at the college I ended up doing the arts degree at.
And can you think of any specific examples where the benefits music had on some of the kind of service users you were treating?
Oh, I think it was mainly just they just really got into it. I mean, people with special needs do, you know, they don't have those inhibitions. Mm-hmm. I think that a lot of adults have, and they just totally got into it. And,
great.
I also found that when I was doing the art therapy working in Bex Hill, it's not that far away, is it,
right.
Bex Hill, a special school there, and I really enjoyed that, working with the children. Those amazing experiences. I mean, one girl with cerebral palsy ended up, she wanted to paint my face, you know, and
I thought, oh, blimey, am I allowed to do that? I suppose so. And it was incredible because the range of emotions and feelings that could be expressed that way. You know, so one time I looked beaten up and all cuts and bruises, you know, she was angry with me. And another time I looked kind of festive, you know, sort of decorated. And yeah, it was
a form of communication,
really amazing experience. Yeah.
Great. And you obviously did a personal study about synesthesia. Firstly, could you tell us what synesthesia is, if you're happy to discuss it, and what you discovered in this study and how you've utilised what you've learned since?
Yeah, I became interested in synesthesia because it's actually a mixture of the senses, a mixture or a blending of the senses. So that means that someone who's listening to music might see colours that go with the music, mm-hmm. or forms, shapes, often even names that'll associate, see certain colours. So it's like hearing colours or seeing sounds, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. And it can, of course, be induced by various substances as well.
Yep, yep.
But what became interesting to me, I think I came to it through the philosophy of Merleau-Ponty, who was interested in how we experience the world through our thinking bodies. So he was emphasising the body and the senses and the way that we thought and sensation are quite close, connected for him.
Mm.
And I found that quite interesting. And I came to the conclusion that we were probably all synesthetes to begin with. All the senses were mixed when we're born. And they gradually, you know, there's always pruning of brain cells as you get older. That happens, and all that, for most people, that falls away as they get older. And also, I was thinking in terms of people, thinking of the bullying I received at school. I thought, if you're a synesthete and you start to describe how you could see, you know, you could see sounds and stuff like that, you get a right stick for it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So you probably, oh, you're weird. So probably there is a certain society pressure to separate the senses out. And to conform in that way. That was what I was particularly interested in.
Fascinating stuff. Yeah, great. And you did that, was that like your dissertation for your art psychotherapy? Was that something you studied away?
After that, yeah. Right. I had the idea of writing a book about it, but I never quite... I got as far as writing essays on it for InScape, the art therapy, and it never got accepted. I couldn't quite get, they kept writing back to me saying, oh yeah, we're interested, but change it a little bit, do a bit of this, do a bit of that. And I felt like in the end I was trying to play some academic game that I couldn't understand what the rules were. So I kind of gave up on that. And also in the meantime, other people were coming up with similar ideas. I think it's more or less, well, it's certainly accepted that synesthesia is a reality, because now they can actually look inside the brain while people are sensing things, and they can see the parts lighting up. So they can see in a synesthete's brain the visual part lighting up when they hear things. So, that's objective proof that it exists.
Yeah.
And then from there, I think other neurologists were exploring the possibility that we did originally start out with like that, and the senses were separated out. So I thought, other people beat me to it.
Oh.
But I suppose more recently I've been reading a lot about all the research in neurology with music, because they're looking into people's brains while they're listening to music or improvising music.
It's fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's a really exciting field. Unfortunately, the machines are still a bit unwieldy, but I sort of have a dream that hopefully in the future, you know, the way that everything becomes shrunk down, all the technology, you might be able to have your own brain scanner you could take home and play around with. You
know? Yeah, one day.
I wonder what's going to happen if I listen to Merzbow and see what my brain does, you know, or something like that, and that could be fun.
Cool. Fascinating stuff. Get that book written. Get that book written. Okay, so we'll begin to wrap up, because I know you've got a sound check to get to. So just one thing, obviously working as a psychiatric nurse and working as a musician at the same time, do you see that's where the kind of future of the music industry is going, is that apart from the kind of real, real top 1% who can make a full-time living out in the music industry, how it is at the moment, you know, there's little money in the music industry. Do you think that it's going to go forward that, you know, artists are going to be juggling other work as well as kind of, music work as such?
Yeah, well, it's always been a problem. I mean, if you look at the history of music, It always seems to be an either-or situation. The people either really, really struggled, or else they got rewarded beyond perhaps what they needed.
Yeah.
So it's always been a problem.
But so it's not a new thing, you don't think?
No.
Oh, okay.
So, I mean, look at poor old Bach. I mean, he was employed by the church, and he had to do churn out all this church music. Well, I mean, he loved it, and he was great at it, obviously, but I don't think they appreciated what they were getting.
Yeah.
And, of course, now I listen to it. Bloody hell, that's incredible. You could hear the, you know. So I think then you started to appreciate composers about Beethoven sort of time, because he had such a strong personality. Mm. So, oi, you're going to listen to what I'm doing, or else you can bugger off, you know, kind of thing. And from then on, I think it got a bit inflated. So you've got people being, like Wagner, being worshipped. Mm. And then that comes into the 20th century with rock stars in the 70s.
Yeah.
Who were perhaps adulated beyond what they needed.
What was necessary.
Yeah. So, but yeah, the problem now, of course, is that you can't really make... it's very, very difficult to make any kind of living from what you produce. So you can produce loads of recordings and stuff, but they're all going to end up on YouTube or something eventually. And people just get them for free and stuff. So it's difficult to actually make any money from that. So you end up having to do more live work, playing live. That's where you get, you know, they get paid for that.
Yeah.
And that can't yet be reproduced in any other way.
Yeah.
And you can sell stuff, obviously, there at the gig. Mm. You can sell merch and so on. So I think, yeah, you do. I'm so, so glad that I did qualify as a nurse, because obviously I can earn a lot more that way than I could have if I was doing care work.
Yeah.
Care work should be paid better than it is.
Yeah, definitely.
Some of the carers are so good, and they just put up with the worst stuff.
Yeah.
And they don't get paid for virtually nothing. So, yeah, I think it's good to not give up your day job, and unless you're Bruce Springsteen or something.
That's great. Okay, we'll wrap up. I mean, obviously in recent years, the Damned have been awarded a Classic Rock Outstanding Contribution Award for services to rock music for over 36 years. You're currently featuring a new documentary film that's recently been put out in the US. I don't think it's available in the UK, because I've tried to be looking for it this week, but I don't think it's been out yet.
I think he's out trying to get a deal. He's basically taking it from cinema to cinema all over the world.
Right, right.
And he's hoping that somebody's going to, you know, let him produce it, and then it will go out in the cinemas and then become a DVD, I think.
The trailer looked great. I mean, have you seen it yet?
We've seen it twice. Yeah.
Oh, great. And what's it like? Tell us about it. Was it an interesting experience?
Yeah, I mean, it was a tremendously traumatic experience for me. We'd had Wes following us around filming us for like 3 years. And I like playing up to the camera, you know. I like sort of doing all sorts of, sometimes some of the stuff backstage, I have some hilarious stuff going, really funny stuff. And I think, oh, I can't wait to see that, you know, all this stuff, you know. And then the film come out, we went out to Austin for the premiere.
Yeah.
For the festival we were going to play there, and we saw the film. I thought, ah, where's that gone? Where's this gone? Oi, what's this about? Oh, it's all about rat scabies. Oi.
Oh, was it?
So it was like, kind of, it was all about the past more than we are now.
Yeah.
I mean, and so I was kind of, I had such expectations that I was really crushed. And, oh, no.
Yeah.
And in a way...
He'll still have all that footage, though. You could ask him to kind of just put together some of the other stuff. Or maybe some of the DVD extras if it comes out, but...
But I think also I got a bit paranoid, because when we started this lineup, we always had the shadow of Rat.
Yeah.
Rat might stop us. Rat might sue us and take the name away, or Rat might, you know, take over and get Dave back with him, and then, you know, we'll all be ruined. And I thought, oh God, it's all going to go back to that. And, you know, so I was quite traumatized. And then the second time I saw it, I was asked to do a Q&A for it. And in Brighton this time, and the experience was totally different. And part of the reason it was totally different was that in Austin, it was just an in-out job. You were basically, they didn't treat us with they weren't very friendly, weren't very nice, didn't, you know, they just kicked us out unceremoniously after the film. And, you know, it was a bit difficult. So doing it in Brighton, the Commedia are so nice to us. They're really, really pleasant.
Oh, it's a great friendly thing in Commedia, yeah, I know. Yeah,
yeah. And now I had no expectations. I knew what was in the film, so I could kind of sit back and enjoy what was there to enjoy. And it is very exciting, the first part of it, where you see it when it all starts up. And it reminds me of listening to John Peel and this amazing noise coming out. What the hell is this? You know, because it totally shocked my
senses.
Aesthetics.
Yeah.
You know, previously being into psychedelia and prog rock, it was just completely different, this stuff. You know, initially I thought, oh, I don't know if I like this, you know.
Mm.
But as soon as you got it, you know, and you thought, yeah, this is blowing disco and country rock out the water, you know, this is sort of clearing the air, as it were.
Yeah.
And so I started to enjoy the film. I could also see the skill that Wes had used in linking certain things. And of course we are there, we are in it all the way through, playing. Every now and again it switches between the past and the present, and you see us playing and doing stuff. So I'm thinking, no, it's all right, you know, once I dropped my expectations, it was fine. I enjoyed it a lot more, and I enjoyed the Q&A, I got on well with Brian James. He's a really nice chap.
Great.
Great passion for his music.
Yeah.
And so that was great, yeah.
Good stuff. Finally, final question, what ambitions have you got left in the music industry?
Whoa! I suppose maybe the one thing would be that I feel I've never really got my own sound. I don't know, maybe you disagree, but I always feel like I'm copying to some extent other people. Sometimes it's an interesting collage of other people.
Yeah.
I mean, you might get sort of a bit of Frank Zappa and a bit of Gong mixed together, or Pink Floyd and punk mixed together or something.
Yeah.
But it always sort of, there's a lot of Robert Wyatt in what I do. And I always think, I think I wrote to David Allen once saying, I think I'm one of those funny birds that can imitate, really good at imitating other sounds, but I don't have my own voice. So it'd be nice if I could have come up with something one day that actually is mine, you know.
Yeah.
And I think that hasn't quite been done before. I mean, I've just been spending the last 3 years listening to, you know, the history of music, all classical initially, because everything's on YouTube, almost everything.
Mm.
And so I'm just listening. I'm like, God, it's incredible what's been done. You know, how can you add to that? You know, what can you do? But so I suppose it would be something subtly different, perhaps. But what it would be or how, I don't quite know at the moment. So just to find my own musical voice. Would be and produce something and people go, oh yeah, that's him, he does that. would be good.
Fantastic. So you're off to Italy tomorrow for some more gigs, and you're touring around for the next kind of few months. If anyone wants to see the Damned, you'll be able to go on their website. Thanks for joining us, Monty. It's been a pleasure to have you with us. Great insight on the Stage Left podcast, and I hope you've enjoyed it.
Yeah, I definitely have. Thank you very much.
Good stuff. Thanks very much. For more episodes featuring musicians who've worked with the likes of Fleetwood Mac, Bob Dylan, The Beatles, Michael Jackson, Elvis Presley, The Prodigy, Oasis, go to www.thestageleftpodcast.com, follow us on Twitter at @TheStageLeftPod, or like us on Facebook at facebook.com/TheStageLeftPodcast. See you next time.